And from that, then we can sort of trivially derive that the number of cups is identical to the number of saucers, from which we get a term, the number of cups, that refers to a number. And so we get a true answer to the question that there is a number, namely the number of cups, which is identical to the number of saucers, by these trivial transformations from uncontroversial basic claims. Stephen Schiffer has done the same kind of work for terms for properties, like from the seat is red, you can move to sort of trivially, redundantly, to the seat has the property of redness, to there is a property, and settle questions about the existence of properties. He's also done it for events, and we just talked about the propositions stuff. And I've applied this kind of approach in defense of ordinary objects. Well, if we adopt this kind of easy approach to ontology here, again, which I'm not arguing for now, I've argued for it elsewhere, but it solves our problem here. Right, then we already said how we can allow that modal normativism gives us modal truths. We still have modal truths even under modal normativism. And then we can see how, by engaging in trivial transformations, we can derive singular terms referring to modal properties and modal facts. So from, say, a Dey-Ray modal claim like Clinton is necessarily human, you can derive the claim Clinton has the property of being necessarily human, and thereby derive reference to this modal property of being necessarily human, right? In the same sense as we derive reference to all these other kinds of properties, similarly for modal facts. And so on this view, you can allow perfectly well, if you combine it with a sort of deflationary meta-ontology, that there are modal properties and modal facts in the only sense that these terms have, a sense of property and fact that is constituted by these rules that show up in the license to make these kinds of trivial transformations. And this is why I call it a sort of deflationary meta-ontology, not a deflationary ontology. I don't think we should say it's a view in which we have sort of quasi-properties or facts or deflated notion. No, I think the right thing to say is there are modal properties and facts in the only sense that the term property and fact have. The meta-ontology is deflationary. The realism, I think, is straightforward. Well, then you might ask, okay, but then what distinguishes your view, the modal normativist view, from a sort of traditional modal realism like you were trying to distance yourself from at the beginning? Well, the short answer is the meta-ontology and the role these modal facts and properties play in our theory, right? On a traditional or heavy-duty kind of modal realism, modal facts or properties or other possible worlds are typically treated as posits of what there must be out there that's going to serve as truth makers for our modal claims and explain what makes them true. But on this view, these modal facts and properties aren't posited as truth makers, and they're not supposed to be explanatory in any sense. They can't be, you have a sort of normative virtue explanation. So what you've got here isn't an explanatory realism about modal facts and properties, but what you might call a rather simple realism. You ask me, are there modal facts? Are there modal properties? I say, yep. This kind of deflationary meta-ontology can also help the modal normativist deal with certain kinds of apparent counterexample to the view. Here's one that was raised to me by a colleague. Well, look, you say that these basic claims of metaphysical necessity are correlated with constitutive semantic rules, but here's one that's not. Necessarily, numbers exist, for example. And the colleague wanted to say, there's no semantic rule about that. And if you said there was, then you end up saying that our semantic rules make numbers exist, but that's clearly absurd. Right. But of course, if you take the easy approach to ontology, this sort of deflationary meta-ontology, then you allow that there are semantic rules that guarantee that the term number refers, right? Because you're licensed to move from the cups and saucers are equinumerous or from the cups and saucers aren't equinumerous equally to there is a number, right? And so you're guaranteed that you've got a number regardless of whether the cups and saucers are or aren't equinumerous or even whether or not there are cups and saucers, then the number is simply zero, right? And so the sort of metaphysical necessity claim that numbers necessarily exist, right, is an object language correlate, again, of these semantic rules that license the introduction of the singular term for numbers. Okay, the last set of objections that I want to consider involve these kinds of accusations of circularity for the view. Here's a first way of raising the circularity worry. Goes like this. Look, Amy, you are analyzing alethic modalities, these claims of metaphysical necessity, particularly in terms of constitutive rules, treating them as object language expressions of constitutive semantic rules or their consequences. But constitutive rules have to be understood in terms of alethic modalities. Constitutive rules, as Searle originally had them and as you described them, are those rules that must be enforced if the term is to be used at all. So here we have modality entering back into the theory, and you haven't really done anything. All right, well, I think there's a reply available here. And that is that, so we're supposed to understand constitutive rules modally. That seems a natural way to understand them. So we might say, for example, that necessarily term T, say bat sub 1, bat the animal term, is used only if rules R, like apply only where there's an animal, are in effect. So we've got a necessity claim there. But how do we understand the necessarily in that claim? Well, we can understand it in just the same way as a normativist wants to understand all of these necessity claims, as itself being an object language reflection of a constitutive semantic rule, now a rule for the term, right? For when you can say this is the same term as that, something like this. Say that this is the same term as that only if the same core semantic rules are in effect. In short, the strategy is that wherever they are made, whether in first-order metaphysical debates or in the statement of the modal normativist theory itself, basic claims of metaphysical necessity should be understood as object language correlates of constitutive semantic rules. Here's a second, maybe a sort of harder hitting way of raising the circularity worry. This was put to me by Ed Halper in the form of a dilemma. Okay, these constitutive rules you're talking about, are they just arbitrary or do they have to be this way? If you say they're arbitrary, then it looks like it conflicts with the feeling that at least many people have, that we have these constitutive semantic rules we do for a reason, right? And of course, the serious realist wants to say we have the rules we do for a reason, namely, they map the modal features of reality. But if you say they have to be this way, then we've got to invoke the modal features to explain why we have the rules we have instead of going the other way around and using the rules to explain our object language talk of modal features. I think there's a number of things to be said in reply here. First, I think it's fine to say for at least some or many terms, the rules may be fairly arbitrary. Our rules for re-identifying same country, right, after various takeovers and so on, and then going back like Latvia, for example, or same work of literature or same work of music, they may simply be fairly arbitrary. But if you say that, of course, your objector just wants to come back and say, no, forget about those sort of superficial cultural terms. Take our most basic terms in our conceptual scheme, terms for persons, or for, you know, what sometimes get called in the psychology literature, spelky objects, right? These sort of basic medium-sized, trackable, movable lumps of stuff seem to figure fairly basically in our conceptual economy. Surely at least those don't follow really arbitrary rules. They're tracking what it really takes to be the same person or the same objects. Well, in reply, we can deny that these rules are simply arbitrary without saying that they're non-arbitrary because they map the modal features of the world, right? And you can see this again by considering the cases of rules of games. I think there's no temptation to say that the rules of checkers are non-arbitrary because they map our real obligations when playing checkers. They map the real modal features of checkers games. But they're not just arbitrary either, right? It's not arbitrary, for example, that one player controls all the red pieces and the other all the black, instead of one getting 9 red and 3 black and the other getting 9 black and 3 red. That would be a disaster from a pragmatic point of view. It would be awfully hard to keep track of who had rights to move which piece, for example. It's not arbitrary that in checkers that the players alternate moves, rather than one player getting 7 moves and the next one getting 1. Right, that would be a very dull game. You could predict the winner right away. The person with the 1 move for every 7 would be frustrated. No one would play that game. It wouldn't survive. Right, so these rules are non-arbitrary. Although we're not thinking of them as mapping real modal features of reality. Similarly for foul rules, right, in organized sports. They're not arbitrary. They're designed, however imperfectly, to try to minimize the risk of player injuries while keeping the game exciting and moving along in a timely fashion, and so on. So you can allow that these kinds of rules aren't arbitrary without saying that they map modal features, by saying that adopting some rules rather than others can be pragmatically justified. And this may easily go for some of our more basic terms like same person or same object. They track what we care about, our emotional connections, say, to people, or why we track objects in terms of spatiotemporal continuity instead of just fixedly at a single location may aid our survival, right? Because we can sort of re-identify things in a way that helps us find food and shelter and so on. We may even, if the empirical evidence holds out, be able to say that at least some of these basic kinds of rules aren't optional, given the kinds of creature we are, given the structure of our brains or the environment we evolved in, or something like that. I'm in no position to say yes or no to that. I'm not that kind of empirical scientist. I'm not any kind of empirical scientist. But if there's good enough evidence, sure, you can say that. Oh, but doesn't that invoke a metaphysical necessity claim then? No, that would be a claim of physical necessity, not metaphysical necessity, right, given the kinds of creature we are. But of course, again, as I think we saw from the first talk today, these needn't be thought, claims of physical necessity needn't be thought of descriptively either. I haven't got my own account of this worked out. Sellers has a very nicely developed account, and others are working along these lines. But as long as you can adopt some sort of non-descriptivist account of physical necessity, just being more thoroughgoing about your modal non-descriptivism, you're okay with accepting that kind of claim. Now, there may be some who want to say, even that isn't enough to capture the non-arbitrariness I wanted. I want to say that at least some modal claims, say those involving basic laws of logic or mathematics, are necessary in a stronger sense, not just for creatures like us in this kind of environment, but for any creature or thinker. Well, again, I think there's hopes for seeing these, too, in a kind of non-descriptive way. This isn't something, again, that I have fully worked out, but it's easy to see the route to take. We needn't see this as being because these laws sort of match the necessities in the Platonistic heaven where the numbers or the logical laws are. So the normativists needn't deny that in some sense or other we have to have at least some of these rules. We just have to understand, again, these claims of necessity is also implicitly normative. At least some of the laws of specific logical systems may be, again, seen as object language expressions of rules of use for our logical connectives. But others, perhaps the most basic laws of logic or mathematics, perhaps you can see as rules, the force of which must be acknowledged, or it must be sort of accepted as enforced by anyone who is to count as a thinker or reasoner at all. So there's all these sort of options for interpreting these other kinds of necessity claims in a similar non-descriptivist way. And if we can do that, then what we have isn't circularity, just a very thoroughgoing consistency about our modal non-descriptivism. Okay, so the recurrent lesson then from all of this, I've tried to deal with some of the major objections that I've been hearing, is if you're going to go deflationary and you're going to accept modal normativism, go all the way. Do it thoroughly and combine it with a kind of meta-ontological deflationism, deflationism about meaning and truth, and you're all right. And if you do that, then there's good hope that of modal normativism that we can work it out, by which, of course, I'm licensing you to reject the inference that we won't. Okay, that's it.
I like the deflationism, except with one about propositions. I'd like you to tell me more about indicative sentence. I don't know if there's a shift or maybe indicative sentence with the proposition and P, because it truly can't mean any indicative sentence, because that would be a kind of syntacticalism. Does he mean, or do you mean, that you can plug into indicative sentence clothes, green ideas, sleep furiously, or, you know, my tomato is the square root of 36.
Oh.
Because there's a modality or something like a modality involved in the notion of making sense.
Yeah.
And it's a big philosophical problem what the relationship between making sense and being possible is, of course. But it looks like there's a sneaky other modality lurking there somewhere, and it has to be satisfied, I think, to have deflationism, because you don't want deflationism to give you this inanity of just any syntactically well-ordered bit giving you a proposition.
Yeah, okay, good. That's one I hadn't thought about before. And I don't know if Schiffer discusses that explicitly. He's obviously developed this stuff on propositions a lot more thoroughly than I have. I tend to rely on him on this. It seems to me like the right way to go is to, and I can't remember the exact way he states it, is to treat the rule as being from something like, you know, from any well-formed indicative sentence and deny that these kinds of category mistake type things are sentences.
Well-formed is not going to be.
Okay, or meaningful or something like that. But now there is a modal element in there, and I think the trick, again, will be to just treat that modal element in a similar way, that is, in accord with the rules of use for English, right, and including the meaning use, not just the syntactic rules, but also the semantic rules that prevent us from combining these things, to try to, again, get a sort of bootstrapping kind of fully consistent view rather than a circular view. So something along those lines, but I can't remember the details if Schiffer addresses that at all.
The deflationism about truth has the same problem, because the P, and P is true, it's only if P, that also has to be an indicative sentence, but it has to be a meaningful sentence. It can't just be syntactically well ordered. Or maybe Orange wants it to be that.
I have a very long list of hands. Currently, James Bateman and Greg Restall, Ray Langford, Richard Holton, Paul Orridge, John McFarlane, and Lionel Shapiro. Apologies if I missed you. Please put your hand up again if so. And since the list is so long, I want to encourage people to be as brief as possible, please. James, you're next.
Okay, I'll be brief by talking really quickly. So with reference to the easy way in ontology, you made reference to neo-Fregeanism and the philosophy of mathematics. So I was going to object that it's not that easy. So one, you have to have an abstraction principle because you have an identity criterion for the new entities. I didn't hear what the identity criterion was for known properties or known facts. Two, we know that not all abstraction principles are okay because based on your five gives us contradiction. And three, that program is kind of given plausibility in the philosophy of maths because Hume's principle plus Hume's principle and second order logic, you can derive the Peano Dedekind axioms. But I didn't see yet. Have you got anything analogous in the vocal case to that? So what's your abstraction principle? How do you know it's not going to end in contradiction? And have you got an analog of Frege's theorem?
Okay, brief question. okay, first of all, yeah, so I think that this sort of easy approach to ontology, it's in the same ballpark as the Neo-Fregeans, but I don't develop it in exactly the same way that relies on an abstraction principle and so on. My work is a little bit closer to Schiffer's probably than to Hale and Wright's. It does face, the sort of easy approach faces the standard challenges of how to ensure there's not a contradiction in these kinds of introduction rules or transformation rules. And I said something about that elsewhere. The short story, I think, of course, the usual method is to add as part of the view requirements on what these transformation rules must involve in order to be well-formed, requirements of consistency, conservativeness, well-formedness. Schiffer has a version of those requirements. I've twiddled them a little bit and sort of changed the well-formedness requirement a little bit. I won't be able to sort of recite them all perfectly precisely right now, but you have to add in those kinds of requirements for the guarantee of existence, I think, to apply. But there's still some challenges, right, like making sure that doesn't just look arbitrary, like an ad hoc addition to the theory to add these requirements. There's also, I think, more to be said on this issue, which is that in the kinds of case that are typically raised here, the counterexamples where you've got a real problem in the rules usually involve explicitly defined introduced terms that have some sort of problematic rules, like tonk, of course. For ordinary language terms, at least, which is mostly what I trade in, I think these aren't as worrying because identifying the rules first requires an act of interpretation. And in interpreting, then, the principle of charity requires us to try to interpret these rules in a way that's consistent.
About the entry and the exit verb.
Yeah.
And you've got a significant entry verb, and it's not clear whether you've got any kind of exit verb, which says what's the force of saying that something is necessary. You've got kind of inter-theoretic connections between necessity claims. You've got an entry verb, but when I say that something is necessary, what else follows from that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the sort of standard exit verb, the necessarily P. If it is really P and P, but you have something else in mind?
It doesn't do much constraint, because that would work if it just meant it's true. So
okay, just like a kind of constraint again. Yeah, but it's not that I don't have some exit move, which is that it's not sufficiently distinguishing.
Good.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, maybe I have a question about the comparison with rules of chess. There's the modality involved. It's just move this way. There's no option. But that non-arbitrariness, that categorical imperative, to put it in your sort of in your normative way, seems to be something that the realist has got an explanation for, which your way of thinking doesn't have an explanation for. Because, you know, as far as you're concerned, there are just these different games. So as applied to personal identity, there's the person game, there's the teleporter game, there's the hibernator game, and, you know, if you want to be a person, think about yourself this way. If you want to be a teleporter, think about yourself this way. And these are the rules that will, the optional rules, like, it's just like playing chess or checkers. And pragmatically, of course, much more simple to be a teleporter, even if the person is going to be dead. Who cares? I'm a teleporter. Anyway, it's partly a question about the categoricity of the imperative supporting a realist understanding of modality, perhaps.
Yeah, okay, good. So let me talk a bit about that. That's right. I mean, I think the sort of going by way of rules of games approach is a kind of hangover of my earliest work on this. And I still like it because I think it's really helpful in a sort of pedagogical way to see what might be going on here. But it does have the danger that it may end up making the view look too traditionally conventionalist, like these are just mere sort of arbitrary conventions like the games, the rules of the game of chess or checkers. And I don't mean to allow that these, or just to assert anyway, perhaps to allow, but that these relevant rules are always purely conventional. I think a hell of a lot of them are. And I think a lot of these issues, a lot more than most metaphysicians realize. So of course, a lot of the sort of metaphysical debates that I've trafficked in, the sort of first order ones before I got into all this stuff, involve modal issues about works of music, or works of fiction, or our countries, or, I mean, in all these cultural and social cases, I think they really are, to a large extent, made by us. Now, they're still not optional in this sense, right, that if you want to be talking persons, and if you want to be part of our discursive community, or let me move back to songs, if you want to be talking pop songs, and part of our discursive community when we discuss whether My Sweet Lord is the same song as another one, then you've got to be following these rules, right, or else you're just changing the subject. So in that sense, you can certainly still treat even those as obligatory or non-optional. And in that sense, as categorical, if you're to be a user of this term at all, anyway. But I also do want to allow, as the sort of ending stuff on arbitrariness suggested, that not all of the rules have to be merely conventional in this sense. And maybe the question is whether the serious modal realist really has an explanation. Does he have something to say? Oh, these are modal features of reality, right? But without more to say about how we can discover them, it's not really so clear to me in what sense this can do explaining. Whereas I can at least offer the beginnings or defer to others who can offer sort of empirical views about the non-optionality of some of these basic tracking or re-identification rules for persons or for Spelke objects or something like that. And I'm quite open to a sort of Kantian transcendentalist explanation of the non-optionality of some of the really, really basic rules. So to that extent, I think at the end of my paper, it ought to end up looking a lot less conventionalist than it might look at the beginning with the analogy of games.
Richard.
So this is really an invitation just to let you say some more about the circularity response. But to make it slightly more pointed, when you give the introduction rule, you gave it by saying, if you've got P, then box P. And it was your slide and what you said slightly diverged, and then what you said was, well, you're permitted under those circumstances to put in box P. So there's a feeling there that one's looking again to a certain kind of linguistic modality that lies behind to a certain kind of geontic modality that lies behind the rule itself. And I was wondering whether you could say something about why there isn't a certain circularity involved there.
Okay. So I guess the hope would be that, yes, what I thought of myself as trying to do in that section of the paper was to try to articulate some of the constitutive rules of use for necessarily itself. As long as we can understand those constitutive rules of use deontically rather than alethically, right, as requirements for those who are going to be part of our community that uses this term necessarily, right, then we're not appealing to a deep sense of real modal factor properties in the world, right? Elithic modality in that sense, to explain it. So the hope again would be to do a sort of across the board analysis and say, yeah, we've got to allow, so my view is sort of deeply normativist, right? It's not looking merely to regularities, but that these constitutive rules themselves may be understood precisely as that, right? As rules, as involving obligations and permissions, not as things that are supposed to reflect some deep modal properties of truth. It's really that kind of metaphysical view about modality, about Eleuthic modality, that I'm trying to step away from.
Yeah, okay, good. So one thing I was slightly confused in, the way you portrayed the project initially was to reduce the Eleuthic to the deontic.
Yeah.
But then later I got the impression you were trying to give an account, some kind of entirely use-based account of the deontic. And it felt as though the point at which you were trying to do that was kind of circular in terms of the deontic, that is.
I'm not trying to eliminate the deontic at all. I don't think I can do that. At least I know how to do it. So yeah, so it's meant to be totally non-reductive and limitative, or non-limitive and non-reductive about the deontic. That's right. Yeah.
Paul. Question of physics comes to the idea of learning these modal notions in inferential terms, the way you get rid of the Frege-Gitch problem.
Oh, good.
But this is a reservation I have is about, it's in the spirit of one of the objections you considered, the objection from somebody who said, well, what about the existence of numbers? Isn't that metaphysically necessary to not tie to anything particularly semantic? I'm also worried that metaphysical necessity isn't that closely connected with issues of semantics.
That it isn't, eh?
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right. And in that case, someone might say, well, you know, I don't really think it's a semantic matter to believe that there are numbers. After all, it's sort of people can there are skeptics about numbers. People can have debates about whether numbers exist or don't exist. They all use it. Communicating, presumably use the word number with its meaning. Some of them accept that there are numbers and some don't, and still mean the same thing. So there are worries about your response to that case. But I think maybe some clearer or some further examples of metaphysical necessity that don't in a clear way connect with semantics are some of those that emphasize by Kripke. One of them is those principles which have as antecedents non-modal claims and then as consequence a modal, like if Hesperus is identical to Phosphorus, then it's necessarily identical to Phosphorus. It's hard to see what notion that relates to the semantics of what term. Hesperus, Phosphorus, identity, what is it? And similarly with some of his other examples. Is a human being, that is necessarily a human being. Such and such is made of wood, is necessarily made of wood. These don't seem to be. How are you going to motivate the idea that these are ways of articulating semantic rules, and what semantic rules do you articulate?
Good, yeah, and I meant to sort of say explicitly that those are the cases I had to deal with. I thought a little bit about de re modality. Last time I was here, which is why I didn't now. Let me just write down all of the aspects of that question, and I'll come back to treat it in turn. So, okay, so let me run through some of those issues in order. On the numbers case, this again is something that I talk about a lot elsewhere. Like sort of, there've been sort of two halves of my work lately. One half is on the sort of modality stuff, and the other half is on this sort of meta-ontological deflationism, and that's where an easy approach to ontology where I deal with that. It's one cost of my view, or one often raised objection to my view, that it looks like I have to end up saying that if it's a constitutive rule of use for the term number that entitles you to infer there is a number from either the Cups and Saucers or Equilibrium or the Cups and Saucers or Equilibrium or any other, a number of other claims, that it looks like I have to say that those who deny the existence of numbers are misusing the term.
And I think there's a sense in which that's right. I mean, obviously, I think they use the term, they're competent speakers in their ordinary life when they use number. But I do have to say that when they come into these kinds of philosophical discussions, that they are sort of violating these rules that they have mastered in their common speech, probably often by sort of artificially inflating the conditions for what it would take for there to be a number, by sort of associating them with conditions that would be appropriate only for there to be an entity posited by the physical sciences, that is, that it plays some explanatory role in our theories, for example, or an entity, a physical object, or something like that. So that is a consequence of the view that's to be taken into account. I don't have to say they're incompetent speakers. I do have to say that they are basically sort of twisting or revising the rules of use for number in their theories. And perhaps you can understand in a slightly more sympathetic spirit as them sort of proposing a revised language in which we use our terminology differently that might be more useful for certain scientific or other purposes. So that's absolutely right. On the sort of de re modal cases, I've written this all out, let me see if I can rattle it off. I do want to try to understand those also as reflections of semantic rules. Now, there's all sorts of different kinds of semantic rules, right, as you've said probably more than anybody else. There's not only sort of word-word rules, as you might say, like apply that only where a man is to be applied, but what you might call world-word rules that particularly apply for ostensive terms. So the de re necessities, the claims of de re necessity, are reflections of, sort of object language reflections of these kinds of world word rules. So, actually, I'm going to pull up my notes. I got this out. And I'll do it more properly. See if this works for you. So the idea is that you will start with a certain rule, right, as you baptize a person, of the form something like, call this person N, call this person you, right? From that, you can get this sort of object language correlate that this person is you, right? Then we also have a rule that says that this person is, in quotes now, is a person name, right? Which you can move down to the, by semantic descent to the object language and say, this person is a person. Then we can substitute identicals, right, and allow that since this person is a person and this person is Hugh, that Hugh is a person, and this is still a sort of consequence of all of these sort of object language expressions of rules. So it's got regulative status, so we're permitted to add the necessity operator and say necessarily Hugh is a person. So since the sort of rule is world-oriented, right, the rule is about this here, right, then if it's a rule that we were to call this person you, that if this person is also the tallest man in the room, or sorry, I shouldn't say that, is also the, what's your title going to be?
The Bertrand Russell Professor.
That's right, the Bertrand Russell Professor of Philosophy, right. Then we can just substitute in, no problem, it's also a rule concerning the Bertrand Russell Professor of Philosophy, concerning you, concerning this person, and allow the same necessity applies to them. So it's sort of rule about this thing, that it's a person. This is the sort of object language correlate of the rule that this person has to use the person name. I hope that made sense. You see why I had to rattle it off from there.
Aren't you assuming that names are always tied to a particular kind of thing?
Yes.
So person name.
Yes.
To,
yes, I argue that
separately.
Right?
I mean,
well,
I
don't.
But anything you want. I mean,
this is something, again, that requires separate argument, and obviously it's not a view that's accepted by everybody. It's something that I argue for at length in ordinary objects on grounds of the need for it to avoid the qua problem. So you have this sort of the problem of what it is that I require reference to in a sort of ostensive situation, or whether reference is achieved at all. And so I argue that you have to have association with some sort of, actually, the way I put it is in terms of application, basic application and co-application conditions for that kind of reference to be achieved. So I do think there's a kind of analytic semantic content even in names and demonstratives, which obviously isn't the mainstream view, but at least my views hang together. Whether they're true, I'll leave out there.
Okay, John McCall.
All right, well, originally I had Greg's question, but then it sort of morphed after hearing your answer to James' question. And so I think Greg's worry was that the elimination rule you have, box P, therefore P,
extensive introduction rule. But now I'm wondering whether the objection should be that it's too strong, because after all, you said in response to James that you're happy to allow inconsistent constitutive rules. And if you've got inconsistent constitutive rules, and you can bring those up into Box, and then you can bring Box down into a plain statement, then that makes your that gives you inconsistent object language claims, which I take it you don't want. So you know, if you had an elimination rule that didn't allow you to get P from Box P, then it could be okay if you had inconsistent constitutive rules, because they wouldn't make your language inconsistent. So what do you think about?
Okay, good point. I think I said something a little more subtle in response to James, which isn't that I'm happy to allow these inconsistencies, but that it's not clear that we have to sort of screen them out. It's not clear what to say. What they do is to raise some interesting questions. What you point out, I think, gives us good reason to be more hesitant about allowing them. That is to say, I wanted to make the response that says, the right thing to do if you discover an inconsistency in the rules isn't obviously to just be eliminative, to just deny that there are such things. But the right thing to do might be to go back and revise the rules. And we might have to go back and revise the rules a little bit, or reinterpret the rules, before we can go ahead and engage in these kind of transformations that will guarantee the existence of the thing and that will license us to be using this kind of modal talk that we could stick it on the rules, right? So we might, that what you say is good reason for requiring that before we stick the modal operator on, that we've got a set of consistent rules. Or also do something else. So I'll have to think more about that. Let me make a note to self. I don't want to be happily embracing non-contradiction, just saying it's a slightly more subtle issue, I think, for a lot of our ordinary language terms. Let me just scribble that down.
You said that you're proposing that modal claims are object language correlates of semantic rules. You also express that by saying they reflect semantic rules, they express, they convey. I was wondering if you could say a bit more, this is partly sparked by Michael's talk, about what this expression conveying, reflecting comes to. Sellers, in response to the question he asked himself, are modal claims metalinguistics, right? We saw says, neither a simple yes nor a simple no will do. If he had answered, well, they are object language correlates, that wouldn't on the surface have added that much. So I was hoping you might say something about what the expression conveying, et cetera.
Yes, it's a transposed language of norms. I like that phrase too. It's a struggle. It's something that I've really struggled with, as you can tell by the number of different formulations. I don't want to say that they're metalinguistic. This is something I spent a lot of time on in the last time I was here, sort of trying to distinguish these kinds of object language, whatever's, of rules from statements of rules and meta-language statements about rules. And I think all those kinds of confusion are basically what have kept conventionalism off the map. And sometimes I think they're misread by the critics of conventionalism, sometimes they're misspoken by conventionalists themselves. So they're not meta-language, and it's important to notice that because they're in the object language, in that sense, we can say that they are also world-oriented, and that's a sense in which we can still say, on my view, that these metaphysical modal claims are metaphysical, and they are about the world, not about language. But I've had a hell of a time coming up with what the right word is, or much less anything else to say, so I sort of sympathize with Sellers here, and I like his language transposed, actually, of what else to say. I mean, I can give examples, right, of how we can move from saying apply bachelors only where man applies to necessarily all bachelors are men, or how we can move from saying apply Smith only to a person, to saying Smith is necessarily a person, and so on. So I can get these kinds of examples, and I've toyed with all these different forms of words, and I haven't got much more. I'm not sure if there is another word for it, and I would very much welcome suggestions, or what else can be said, or what the demand is to say more, if there is a way to say more. So I kind of feel your pain, because I struggle with it myself. But I don't know how much more can be said about this relationship, that it's this kind of move that we can make as we engage in a kind of semantic dissent. And I'm very much open to people's suggestions about what, at least if you got to choose some one word, like, well, conveying is tricky. I used to talk more about conveying. That's clearly the functional end of things, right?
Functional in the sense of making a modal claim has the function of getting people to accept or behave according to.
That's right. And as soon as I started saying that, people started hitting me with the frigging each problem, right? And so I stopped saying that so much. It's unless I'm doing it explicitly first by saying, here's the function of modal discourse, now here's the meanings, to make it clear that we can sidestep that kind of problem. So I try to, when I'm not explicitly in that kind of dialectic situation, to not use the term conveying anymore, unless I'm explicitly talking about the function, and to talk instead about these metaphysical, basically it's metaphysical necessity as object language expressions or reflections of these constitutive semantic rules that might be less misleading and stated in the meta language, and say something about why it's useful to do it that way. But another word for what this relationship is, apart from it involves semantic descent and so on, I'm kind of at a loss, and I would definitely, you know, appreciate any helps. Or if anybody says, oh no, don't use expressing or reflecting for this reason, then tell me and I'll try to get at least the best choice of terms that I can, whether there's more that can be said in the way that there's sort of the demand that sellers say more. Yeah. Again, if you got some, tell me.
Okay, the person in the middle, I'm sorry, I've forgotten.
Charles. So yeah, this is kind of the other side of the numbers. At this point, today we had a series of statements that didn't look like they were analytic. And so I'm worried about analytic statements that don't seem to be necessary.
That
these are indexical truths, like I'm here now, be even only if actually be, and they seem to be kind of too much of the constitutive rules of what language, but they're not necessary.
So. Yeah. So you need to do some fancy footwork there. Kirk Ludwig has done this rather nicely. So I'll just footnote him for that. You need to do some distinguishing between the rules governing, rules governing our terms versus what they express in a given context. So a lot of those cases are cases involving demonstratives, and then it's sort of, so I am here now is guaranteed to be true whenever I say it, or whenever you say it, or whenever anyone says it. But the content of the sentence is something different when I say it than when you say it, right? I don't know how to sort it clear in my head now, but that's the rough direction to take in addressing that side of the counterexample. I didn't mention it all in this paper. And again, I think that that work's been done better by Kirk Ludwig. I mean, I don't think there's much that I can do to improve on it apart from reference him.
Thank you.
Thanks for the talk. I heard sort of two slogans and coming out of the talk, and I kind of wanted to ask about the relation between them. So one of them is the term necessary is used as an object-level way of conveying constitutive rules of use for various terms. Another is that we should understand elitic modalities in terms of deontic modalities.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the reason I'm wondering about the relation between them is that there seems to me to be all sorts of different flavors or levels of elitic modality. You know, there's conceptual, there's logical, there's mathematical, there's physical, there's maybe biological. And I'm not sure you want to claim that all of those are object-level ways of stating rules. So I guess the question is it only the metaphysical ones that are the object-level ways of stating rules? And then how is that supposed to relate to all the others?
Okay, good. The only ones that I mean to be making any claims about in this talk are sort of metaphysical, because of metaphysical necessity and possibility. And again, that's a sort of artifact of the fact that I started out from the metaphysics corner of things here. It's only those that I'm claiming are object language, expressions, reflections of constitutive semantic rules. Now this requires, again, to make the view work well, you really want to have a consistent kind of normativist view of modality across the board. I haven't worked out the details, right? But other people have been working out the details of a view along those lines, like Bob Brandom's work, obviously, in Sellers on Physical Necessity. I'd like to be able to ultimately see all what these sort of claims of necessity all have in common. I'll use the term necessity, whether you're talking physical or mathematical or metaphysical, as being sort of object language expressions of rules. But one might see them as still different in certain respects. That is, the metaphysical ones as reflective of constitutive semantic rules, the physical ones perhaps as reflecting rules of inference based on empirical evidence, something along those lines. And the mathematical or logical ones, at least the sort of most core ones, as reflections of rules of thought for anyone who's to count as a thinker or reasoner at all, perhaps, at least the most basic ones. Now, all of that's going to require a lot more detail to work it out and make it plausible, but that's the sort of direction, at least some of the differences. I also really like the idea from this morning's talk that there may also be differences in this sort of epistemic status that perhaps go along with this, or the epistemic rules governing these different kinds of claims of necessity. But that's roughly how this is just a little piece of the story, but how it ought to fit into a bigger picture that at least so far looks kind of globally plausible, though it'll require a lot of refinement to make it work out.
We have room for, I think, one more question if anyone's got one.
Well, I just have a follow up on the previous. Your response to.
Because you've read something else, haven't you?
This is about the whether you can have semantic principles which aren't and correspond to methods or necessities. And his example, you managed to get around by saying, well, it depends on the context and blah, blah, blah. There are other examples, like a tricky game, like a meter is the length of such and such a road in Paris or something, where you say, well, that defines the word meter, but it's not something that's necessarily true.
So
it's not a question of, index counts.
Right, that's a more thoroughgoing problem, so I'll have to think about what to say about that. Thanks.
I was just wondering. This is related to Lionel's question.
To
Lionel's question. I was wondering. So you made this distinction between saying something being descriptive and saying something being regulative. Quite early on. So I was just wondering how tightly you wanted to tie the two different things that are done to the forms of words used to do them, or at least in your examples. So you had these examples where you say something like, black moves first in the game of checkers. That's regulative, and perhaps in so saying, I put a norm on display and kind of say, hey, let's all follow this norm, or something like that. And then you can say something else, like black move to the leftmost checker up and to the left.
Mm-hmm.
That's descriptive. So I was just trying to think of examples where this simple contrast doesn't work very well. So it seems that you can just set out to describe a set of norms rather than to endorse them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just think of something like, say, the legal system of ancient Rome,
mm-hmm.
I can say, the law was blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not attempting to endorse that norm in any way at all.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to describe to you some norm that different people endorse.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want to say about that kind of case where you don't seem to be putting forward the norm as a norm for us, you just sort of seem to be reporting, hey, there's this norm.
That's not exactly the way that I want to put it. This is, again, something I spent a long time on in my first DPR paper. Those would be what I would call descriptions of norms or rules or statements about rules rather than statements of rules. So a straightforward, unembedded statement of a rule has this kind of normative force, right? Although I have to think about its meaning, it shows what its meaning is constant even in an embedded context. But that kind of thing that you're talking about, if you say it was a rule or a law in ancient Greece that, then that's a statement about a norm. And those are obviously related to our statements of norms, but you've got to be careful to not confuse them. I mean, this is the sort of classic objection against conventionalism, right? Says that according to the modal conventionalist, our modal claims are made true by our adopting certain conventions. But that's not right, right? And that would be right if the modal conventionalist view was that our modal expressions are descriptions of rules, because saying it's a rule that such and such in ancient Rome or whatever, that's made true by their adopting certain conventions. But the statement of the rule isn't made true by the adoption of the conventions. It's made meaningful by it, but not made true by it. So to make the view at all plausible, I think one has to be super careful in keeping these kinds of descriptions of rules from statements of rules. And then you got to distinguish those again, sort of meta-language statements of rules from these object language reflections of rules. And only if you get all those distinctions very clear and are very careful about them does the view look at all plausible. But I think a lot of the reason that it's been kept off the table in recent discussions is because of confusions like these. And that's sort of what I spent the first paper trying to do. And even a lot of really good philosophers still just dismiss modal conventionalism in two paragraphs by making that kind of confusion.
Okay, that brings us very nicely to the end of our allotted time. So let's thank Amy.
Thank you.